complex doesn't begin to describe agriculture, but it can be boiled down simply.
I think there's two categories of decisions that are made in farming. There's production decisions and there's marketing decisions. I think that's a mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive list of two, right?
Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and welcome to MTOM, where we meet the show producers and analysts from the public TV show Market to Market in an effort to learn more about them and the stories they tell. Mark Pearson called her the pride of dipstick South Dakota, but there's more to Elaine Cubb than U.S. commodities. She's been globetrotting with good cause for years.
I'm going to ask you in a minute about your world travels, but you just had a conversation with our executive producer, David Miller, and you have stories. I mean, you travel, you've been here enough, you know most of the people, but what did you open up with Dave right there that was interesting?
Well, Paul, as you may know, I am from a little town called Ipswich, South Dakota, right? Mark Pearson used to always call it dipstick, didn't he? Anyway.
Yes, he did, but we won't,
Anyway, long ago, when I first started doing Market to Market, I was out in the, I was leaving after taping a program, and I was out in the parking lot, and Dave was wearing a scarf, and it said Ipswich on it, and I said, what the heck is going on? Why does Dave have a scarf that says Ipswich? And it's an Ipswich Town Football Club scarf from Ipswich, England, that they had a, they have a football team that did very well in the 70s, and they were like a big deal for a while. Anyway, so I just went to Ipswich, England, like in December, just kind of on vacation, and so I told Dave that I now have a matching scarf.
And did you know that? Did you go to Ipswich on purpose because of your connection with your hometown?
Absolutely. I got the mayor of Ipswich, South Dakota to write a little letter, and I delivered a letter to the mayor of Ipswich, England, got a VIP tour, the whole deal. It was fantastic. Great place. Highly recommend it.
And what part of England is it in?
It's in Suffolk. It's about an hour north of London by train, and it's a very agricultural part. I was just telling Dave that the team nickname for the Ipswich Town Football Club is the Tractor Boys, so now it's fantastic. I mean, let's all cheer for the Tractor Boys.
And to be fair, when we say football, we don't mean football. We mean soccer.
We mean soccer.
Because everybody else but us calls it football.
Do your kids play soccer?
Yeah,
Do they call it football or
they
soccer?
They call it soccer.
They call it soccer.
Yeah, they both have played, you know, park and rec.
Well, I didn't know
soccer,
if generationally if kids were going to start internationalizing the sport.
No, because they've got friends that play football. That's a big thing
in
elementary school when you're
to
in fourth and fifth grade to play football.
Okay.
And it got to be so much of a thing at the my oldest, well, they're both at the same elementary this year. The oldest one, they were getting into fights with the kids, and so they had to pick teams. They had to have an independent captains that picked during, before they went out to recess in the school, they had a draft of each other.
Oh my.
Yeah. In fact, I'm wondering if he's texting me right now because he's not supposed to call me on Fridays because usually this is what he's telling me he's home now and I've had this go off like six times and he freaked out the first time because he's like, why is Dad not answering? I'm like, it's Friday afternoon, I really can't, and now that I've started to record this at the time he comes home from school, I'm not able to. That's way more information than you wanted or needed. But so you travel quite a bit. We're going to talk about Africa in a moment. Where have you been traveling this year on the speaker season? Just regular stuff, but what is your topic this year? Is it different than other years? Do you write a new speech each year?
I do try to bring in new material every year because I get invited back to a lot of places, which is always nice. And I hate to bore them with the same charts over and over again. I won't name any names, so the only really interesting thing that I've brought in this year, I had an opportunity. I was invited to go to the South Dakota Precision Agriculture Conference. Now, I'm not really a mechanical equipment sort of farmer. Like, I drive a grain cart. That's about it. So it was kind of funny for me to be standing in front of a room of farmers talking about precision agriculture. But I kind of spun it on the sort of philosophy of precision agriculture that, you know, I think it's a really popular topic and people really cotton on to that idea of getting very precise about calculating what each individual plant needs. Let's be that precise with our marketing. You know, let's take as much time as we're spending switching out seed plates and coulters. Let's spend as much time really drilling down to our per unit costs of production and whatnot.
And I saw on Twitter that someone responded to that, and they hadn't thought of the question. I think you got through at least to one person that that tweeted at you and said, I had not thought of it that way, Elaine. Thank you so very much.
Which, yeah, I was delighted. I wrote my column on DTN on the topic, too, and I thought, well, this is really kind of hokey, right? I thought that I was really stretching it. But no, I'm glad that did resonate for some folks, is like to just take that ethos, that mentality of being precise and taking the time to do it unit by unit, that works out.
When did we have to pay attention to each seed, what it needs, and then the marketing of each seed and ear that comes? When did we have to start paying attention to that small a detail?
Well, I suppose that this mentality or this philosophy has only become possible in the past, 10, 15 years, that the precision planting technology. I mean, previously, you'd go out with your mechanical plate planter and put 25,000 seeds down in a field and or per acre, right? So you could technically dump a pile of 25,000 seeds, and that's technically 25,000 seeds on that acre. But when the equipment made it possible to track it, particularly geographically, I mean, I think really the definition of precision agriculture is to geographically be able to drill down per unit.
And to monitor those things now, whether it's a time lapse of how the seed grows or... To me, that is still so fascinating how you can – I can watch stuff on your farm if I wanted to right now. You could show me if this was the growing season, which it's not. I just think that is so interesting how you can be on one side of the 40 taking the corn still out of the field, and the co-op comes in on the other side and they're already bringing in your fertilizer, and you can sit there at the shed and see both of those things going across your screen, going from two different crop years within hours of each other.
Yeah. I mean, someday we'll be sitting in our basements just clicking on a screen and we won't even have to be outside. No.
We can work all day, all night. And farming really could be
from
different.
From the beach.
And there's probably plenty that might actually try it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they do.
Someday.
Some of them sit there and monitor. You can monitor the hen house on your phone. You can monitor the hog house, whatever it is. Same with the field. You know what you got for moisture on those things. To me, that's overwhelming. And if you spend so much time trying to figure out how's the best way to care about that seed, I suppose you forget about the marketing side of things.
Right. We can put almost, I think this is true, or help me think this through, but I think there's two categories of decisions that are made in farming. There's production decisions and there's marketing decisions. I think that's a mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive list of two, right?
And they're huge things.
Yeah, but that's it. So they should be shared in importance.
And not one over the other, because you can't have one without the other.
Right.
Because if you don't succeed on the marketing side, you're definitely not going to be able to do another production side.
I mean, you could.
Might. Just might not be if you get lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike was on the beach this week on his trip. He did not know that I had talked to one of your DTN colleagues. Phil in Ontario, Canada, was on the podcast before this. Tell me about Darren's a full-time employee of DTN, and that has been on your resume as you're considered a contributor now. Is that what that is?
Yeah.
So you and Phil would that make you colleagues then, and how that works? Are you both contributors?
Yeah, I guess. As a side note, Phil is the one who first convinced me to get on Twitter at all. Like he was the evangelist of Ag Twitter. I think he is the godfather of Ag Twitter.
He actually told a story in the podcast that he had a boss up above him that said, you need to do Twitter, Phil. And he was like, no, I don't.
That's
not for me. And he goes, I went home that night and did it. He goes, within 30 seconds, I saw the value of it. And he was you were a disciple of him on Twitter.
Yeah. So now I'm looking forward to this podcast.
You'll have to listen to it. With that being contributors, what's that network like of their contributors? What's the variety? How are you picked to be those types of people for them? For
I don't know that. For me personally, I was previously a full-time analyst,
right,
with Darren. So I suspect that's how I got roped in. How they found Phil or their other Canadian grains analyst or like John Harrington, their livestock analyst, super, super in touch with what's going on in the livestock markets. He's from Nebraska, so I suppose they probably just found him through some Nebraska cabal, right? I don't know, but I don't know their process.
Okay,
that's what you ought to do is get Greg Horsemeyer, the editor, in here and
find out.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's good enough. I think the next time Angie Setzer comes back, I'm going to have Carl, her husband, sit with me because they both do the same thing and they both discuss, as she mentioned in this week's podcast when we're recording this week's, I should say. That's a time warp thing that I'm mm-hmm. throwing everybody off of. But Carl and Angie have heavy debates about the way they see the grains, and it's in their own house, and they have to turn it off and turn it on.
God, that would drive me crazy.
You know, it's like, well, I thought you were a little bearish on hogs there. Well, I think you're a little bullish on, you know, on this. And so they have.
Wow.
But that's kind of, just think if that's
it's like
how,
a busman's holiday.
Yeah, it never ends.
Yeah.
It never ends. And neither does your traveling. You have gone, we've talked about your trips to Brazil before. We have already talked about your trip to Europe. Oh, we've talked about Brazil
Ipswich,
a little bit.
England, Ipswich, England, yeah.
but you spent some time in Africa.
Yeah.
What were you doing there?
Well, that was – so I went in 2015 to Ethiopia and in 2016 to Uganda. And both of those were USAID-sponsored trips, so they're taxpayer dollar at work, administered by Catholic Relief Services. So they're the boots on the ground there that sort of find the organizations that need some help with marketing or, you know, they need a project. They need some expertise coming in from the United States to bring some technology or expertise over there. So that's what I did. I went in Ethiopia. I worked with a farmers cooperative there that was looking to get some better value addition analysis sort of thing on their maize crop. So they call corn maize, but same stuff. And edible white beans that they were growing there. And they also grow teff, which, I mean, you probably know what teff is.
I don't.
And probably, I know for a fact you can buy it in the Whole Foods in Des Moines because as soon as I got back from Ethiopia, I think I must have come here to do market to market. And I went to Whole Foods that day and I took a picture of the little bag of teff on the Whole Foods shelf just to email back to the folks in Ethiopia and be like, this is how much people pay for these crazy ancient grains here in the health food industry. But anyway,
how do you spell that, by the way?
T-E-F-F. It's this tiny, tiny, tiny little ancient grain. It's used. Have you ever gone to an Ethiopian restaurant?
Mm-mm.
They have a bread, a very unique bread that's called injera, and it's kind of a spongy.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
A spongy
yeah,
tortilla
I've had
kind
that.
Of thing.
Yeah,
yeah. So teff, somehow you don't need yeast. It's self-rising. I don't know. It's really cool stuff. It's amazing.
And it's grown.
Yeah.
In Ethiopia.
Yes.
Where you were at.
It's also grown in the Midwest, Paul Yeager.
Really?
In cover crop mixes. Yeah, absolutely. You can go to cover crop seed sales places and they will sell you teff to put into a mix.
And what's the
it's
benefit?
Probably not. Yeah.
What's the benefit of that here?
I don't know. I mean, the same as any cereal grass would be, any cereal rye, or it's just a grass to put on your cover crop that.
It provides variety in your cover.
Yes, and I mean, and it's soil stabilization, and you know, teff tends to be very tall. I think when it grows, I never could get it to grow the stuff that I smuggled back from Ethiopia. Anyway,
souvenir as
don't,
a souvenir.
Let's not tell the USDA. Nobody listens to this podcast
from the USDA. Right? From the USDA.
Okay, yeah.
We'll pretend that people actually listen to it. But
no, I know
from
they
the USDA.
Do. Hey, I was going to tell you, I know that they do because I mean, I've had. I want to wave hello to Jeff Ryan. I've received emails from people who listen to this podcast. They're big fans out there.
Well, fantastic. We're glad to have. Now I think we're up to four. So
yeah,
Jeff
fantastic.
Would be number four. That
okay.
would be great. So you're in Ethiopia. You're doing stuff with USAID. Plans to go back?
Well, so I think that we are getting a little more ambitious even. So in Uganda, it was a different farmers cooperative, but it was much more direct to the farmers themselves. So in Ethiopia, the farmers cooperative I was working with, I was really working with the management on their sort of value addition projects. In Uganda, I was really going to individual communities and speaking to groups of 100 farmers at a time about their own grain marketing, and really very similar stuff to what we talk about in the United States is seasonally, you'll have the highest prices when the crop is at the most risk and the lowest prices at harvest, almost always, right? So you have to effectively manage how to store your grain and bring it to market at a certain time and average out a price through a year. Blah, blah, blah. Like this is very standard stuff to us here, but it was worthwhile to them there. But it was not terribly efficient to send me at whatever ungodly amount that airplane ticket cost. And let's not even pretend that what is my time worth? Who cares? That's not the point here. But it's not very efficient for me to go one person at a time to one little community when there are millions and millions of farmers. So we're going to get a little smarter, and I think the plan is to do some webcasts. You know, the internet is really quite available on smartphones and all over Africa. So the idea is to do more webcasts about these same sort of topics that can be then delivered to African merchandisers and farm, I don't know about farm level, but more of the co-op and management level, certainly.
It sounds like you could do videos that they could watch.
That's the idea.
And, you know, you have four of them, and then at the end you watch those four. We're going to do a live web chat with three of us. It's a lot cheaper to put you in some extension classroom somewhere or university than it would be.
Exactly. And we get to more people. And it's not just me. They're bringing in vegetable marketing experts, milk marketing experts, all sorts of stuff.
You talked about infrastructure without saying the word. I always think of a lot of the agricultural part of Africa being sans good infrastructure. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
I mean, roads, oh, the utilities.
The roads are so terrible, and that really is the challenge, you know? I mean, you could, I don't know, like so much of our ability to get to a market is because we can just stick it on a truck and go where it needs to go and feel confident that it will get there without busting an axle, you know?
Right.
Or to do it efficiently. So In Ethiopia, everything was on donkeys. Everything was being hauled on little scrawny donkeys that didn't look very happy. And in Uganda, everything was on motorcycles. I didn't see in a single donkey in Uganda, but it's all motorcycles. So you're taking one 100-kilogram sack of maize and sticking it on the back of a motorcycle and going on this terrible potholed road for, I don't know, 100 miles.
So that's how far they're transporting some of their stuff.
Well, not individual farmers, probably.
But so some of it goes into town? I mean, how are they storing it?
Yeah, so the maize is maize for them. It is an export crop, or it's a cash crop that they are trying to grow more than their own family will consume. And then in the region that I was in, it was really quite close, like probably 40 miles from the Kenyan border. And Kenya is relatively a very wealthy neighbor of Uganda. And so that's the idea, is to get this more efficiently traded to Kenyan traders rather than these sort of local traders that can be not entirely honest or fair dealing. You know, so there's no price transparency. A farmer brings his grain to town and he doesn't know that he's getting a good price unless the co-op can build that system to do some good price transparency. Yeah.
Because I see this hayseed coming in, I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Probably what's happening.
Exactly. And there's really no recourse to it. And you talk about infrastructure, like absolutely the roads are one part of that, but it gets more basic than that. You know, we're very lucky to have, well, so far, ask me again in 3 years, 4 years, but so far we have a society where laws exist and are enforced, and we have a judicial system. And if somebody tries to take advantage of you or sells you bad seed, you have recourse. You can sue them. There's a system where you can generally trust people that they will have to be honest, that something will happen, right? They don't have even that very basic level of societal infrastructure.
And where do you begin?
I would begin there.
Begin with the judicial system?
I guess. I mean, I'm not an expert in Africa beyond what I myself have seen, but I think that is at least as important as the roads, probably more important.
Because if you're getting hosed in town, there's no point in traveling on the road
that
could be built. Electricity is pretty well found. Water? Does it depend on the region?
I suppose it depends on the region. Where I was very lucky. I didn't have to live in a mud hut. That would have been cool, but I didn't. I got to stay in a hotel, which had electricity and some internet, but every once in a while, like every day, the electricity would sort of go out. So, I mean, yeah, there was electricity sometimes and sometimes there wasn't. But yeah, I think it is region to region for sure.
Hmm. Do you think you'll go back, maybe not in the capacity you went, but just go to travel?
I think there were really valuable projects, and I know that my schedule in 2017 is not going to allow me to go, but I'm not, I wouldn't rule it out, and I definitely, definitely want to go back in the next 5-10 years, sometime down the road, and hopefully see some progress.
And that would be good.
That'd be awesome.
You know, but Africa as a continent is not going to be a major player for the United States.
Oh.
In how many years, then?
Oh, I don't know that I would say that at all. I think that we really, really need to be paying attention to Africa in the same way that we should have been paying more attention to the Middle East because of the demographics. You know, I think, and again, I'm not an expert beyond just what I've seen, but I saw so many, 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 many children, right? Like, you previously have these birth rates. My understanding is the past 20, 30 years, you'd have a birth rate, but then not all those children would live very long. And now the children are living to adulthood, which sounds great, but they have a huge demographic problem coming up. And it may not be a problem. It may be just this opportunity that this may be like the next Asia. If it's managed correctly, it could be the next Asia for us to be selling things to or exporting technologies to. I mean, it's certainly a possibility, but it absolutely needs our attention for sure.
Not something you can just file away and say, oh, it's just them.
Right. I mean, I think that's been the case forever, right? Like, they have not been a big player in global business, but I think that won't be the case in the future. Hmm. Oh, I was going to tell you, I got to plow with an oxen. Did I tell you that?
No.
Yeah. Oh, I should show you the video. Yeah, it was cool.
So how deep is the plow? Are you talking 6 to 8 inches? And
yeah. And so, I don't know, you've seen the uh-huh. concept, right? And
yeah.
You think that the oxen are doing all the work? No.
Your arms are pretty tired at the end.
Yeah, because you're providing the down pressure. It was a lot harder than I expected it to be. It was really hot out that day, too.
How far did you last? 10 feet to 100 feet?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe 100 feet. I don't know. I didn't want to screw it up. Like,
right.
This is somebody's livelihood.
Sure.
Yeah.
Huh. And that's all part of the gig when you get to travel. You just never know what the adventure will be.
Yeah. And I had to specifically ask. Like, they wouldn't have gone out of their way to make me do it.
So, are there women doing that job?
Oh.
Or are there men doing that job? Is it children?
Boy.
Who's doing that job?
How much time do we have? No, seriously. This is a really big topic. Because the women are farming and they're as responsible for their economic well-being. I mean, there's lots of widows and most of the families are one man and then several wives. And each of the wives are responsible for her own farm, right? And so they're definitely responsible for their own farm work. But it seemed to me that they would bring in a man to do the plowing. Because it does require a lot of physical upper body strength. But and then, you know, especially with Catholic Relief Services, we made a big point of bringing women to the meetings so that you would have women at the meetings. And I always thought that was just the coolest thing, that obviously this was this very egalitarian society where women and men are all farming together. But I think upon hearing more from people more experienced than I or with more expertise than I have, we probably brought them to the meetings, but they may not have felt comfortable even asking questions with their husbands there. It's still an extremely, extremely gender unequal society.
So you're making it sound like the women there are supposed to be, whatever they say, quote, in their place. They have a role, but they're not to be in a head role.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess that's a gentle way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. And so,
you know, I mentioned the number of children, too, right? That there's, I mean, there's just...
So there's single parents if the father is going from three
but
to
I
four
don't
farms.
But I don't know how much choice there, you know, how much... I think as... And it's, I don't think that's true necessarily in the urban African populations, that there are parts of Africa where women become more educated and they have smaller families. But in a lot of rural farming Africa, that's not that's not a viable option for a lot of people.
Hmm. You never know what you're going to stumble onto when you start talking about a topic.
Yeah. And so when I came back from Ethiopia and even like halfway through my trip in Uganda, I still was having these rose-colored glasses. And I still do in the sense that like these people are great. Like they're absolutely kindred spirits to every farmer in Iowa and South Dakota and the U.S. in general. Like a farmer is a farmer. And we're all worried about the rain. And like they're all just like me. And then I see the women out in the fields and I think, well, they're even better than us in America because the women are really out there farming, you know, and there's no discrimination. But yeah, upon further reflection, yeah, there's a lot of problems.
A lot of room for opportunity
and change. Yeah.
And I would suppose, because if you go with the courts or the gender equality, I mean, both are going to take, that's a massive mind change.
Yes, exactly. You're exactly right, is that that's not something you tweak that requires a whole scale reevaluation of family dynamics, everything dynamics, yeah.
And it might take several generations for that to change. And someone halfway through the first generation, 10 years in, is going to go, what are we doing? This isn't working. Told you we shouldn't have let her do this, or we shouldn't have had a court.
Well, you know, are you familiar in economics with the idea of an efficient solution? So an efficient scenario is one where nobody changes and nobody gets better. Right. So if Africa were to give women more power to question their husbands, that might not be seen as a great thing for the husbands. Right. The husbands would be upset at not having these live-in servants anymore, perhaps. So I don't really know. I don't really know how you convince the society to change in that way. But, you know, the internet's everywhere. Smartphones are everywhere. So, like, maybe just globalization, just the moral compass of the globe might, you know, just sort of catch on, hopefully.
The smartphone could be what changes a lot of this.
Maybe.
Huh. Something to ponder.
Yeah.
All right, Elaine Kupp, thank you so very much for sitting down and having a conversation.
Well, thank you for letting me ramble on. I hope I didn't make too much of a fool of myself, because like I said, I, you know, there's people who...
Jeff's listening.
Who really... Well... Thank you, Jeff, for listening. I mean, like, people really have expertise in what it takes to change Africa. I'm not the expert.
But you've done what I think your trip was supposed to do, is that you're telling people about what
That's
is
true.
There and what is happening and what can be done. Just, and then that is how, I never thought of it that way. And then someone goes, you know what, I'm really interested. I want to go.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot of potential there. It was really cool to see. Anybody who's interested should go to crs.org. Farmer to Farmer is the name of the program. CRS Farmer to Farmer program. And in fact, I think there's a lot of other organizations that administer Farmer to Farmer programs in other parts of the world. They're all USAID programs, but they're not all done through Catholic Relief Services. There's a lot out there to do, and I highly encourage people to volunteer with that.
All right. Elaine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be sure to click subscribe if you want more tales like this one. And then, if you feel moved, rate us in the App Store. We sincerely thank you. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.